This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Seth Rogen has written a new book called Yearbook that was described in the Washington Post Review as, quote, a candid collection of side-splitting essays, unquote. He writes about how he started to do stand-up when he was 12. 12! And why it was at a lesbian bar. His adolescent insecurities about girls and not having a girlfriend. His mild case of Tourette's syndrome. His father's Tourette's is more pronounced. How his father became the sperm donor for a lesbian couple, making Seth Rogen the half-brother of their two children. His use of weed, mushrooms, and LSD. How he started acting and making movies. And the threats made by North Korea because of his film comedy, The Interview, in which Kim Jong-un is assassinated. Rogen has produced and or directed, written, or starred in many films, including Knocked Up, Superbad, Pineapple Express, This is the End, The Interview, The Disaster Artist, Steve Jobs, Sausage Party, Long Shot, and An American Pickle. Along with his writing, directing, and producing partner, Evan Goldberg, he founded the production company Point Grey Pictures. They also recently founded a company that sells marijuana. It opened in 2019 in Canada, where Rogen and Goldberg are from, and in March, they opened a branch in California. Seth Rogen, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your new book. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I love the advice you were given by your first comedy teacher, and you were about 12 then, which is that nobody wants to hear what you like. Fun isn't funny. Comedy is pain. It's struggle. So don't ask yourself, what's funny to me? Ask yourself, what bothers me? What frustrates me? What do I wish I could change? That's a pretty sophisticated thought for a 12-year-old to digest. Is that advice you still try to follow?
To some degree, I think failure is more entertaining than success in general. I think a bunch of people screaming at each other, arguing about something, stressed out, is more funny to watch and more entertaining to watch than a bunch of people getting along and having cohesion on something. And so I think the idea that entertainment and comedy comes from conflict, and conflict comes from pain often. I think in general, looking towards that feeling rather than what do you love, what makes you happy, what's going great, is for sure something that I still think about a lot. Yeah.
So with the advice you were given in mind, what was your comedy like when you were 12 performing in front of an audience?
It was about the things that I didn't like. And at that time, my grandparents were probably the major source of stress in my life. And I just really didn't get along with them very well. I would go to their house on Fridays and hang out with them while my family was at synagogue, and they would yell at each other and scream at each other. And that's where my head went as far as what should my first jokes be.
You were going to this comedy class because when your parents realized you love comedy, your mother went and signed you up for this class. You were, I think, the youngest person in the class.
And by far.
Somehow this class had an arrangement with a lesbian bar so that the people in the class would perform there. How was that arrangement made?
I'm not sure. I think it was probably just a cheap space to have a showcase for a bunch of comedians. They knew maybe it would be busy on whatever night the showcase was. It's funny in retrospect. I have no idea, but it was actually in Vancouver, like a pretty famous lesbian bar. So, it was a good crowd, you know. It's always will be a part of my story that the first time I told jokes was in front of around 100 lesbians. Yeah.
So as a 12-year-old boy, did you ask yourself, what's going to go over in front of a lesbian audience?
What's going to go over? I assumed the same things. I assumed the lesbians had grandparents just like I did. And most of my jokes were grandparent based. So I felt confident.
So one of the real surprises for me, at least, in reading your book, was that your father has OCD and Tourette's, and you have a very mild case of Tourette's. Was that actually diagnosed?
A doctor was like, yeah, you know, you you likely have it due to your father and due to the symptoms you, it was, I would say it was like, you know, informally diagnosed, but doctors, I have talked to doctors about it. Yes. and it is genetic. It's heavily genetic. And my dad was diagnosed. And so, yeah, doctors were like, oh, do you twitch a lot? Yes. Do you have a hard time sitting still? Yes. Do you, it was passed on to you basically.
Can I ask you what your father's symptoms have been and what it was like for you to observe him when you were a child?
I mean, it's something that I think most people wouldn't notice. Like, honestly, it's something that I think unless you are in tune with it, my dad just doesn't sit still. He still, even to this day, like doesn't sit still. He just kind of is always moving and swaying and, you know, just kind of just can't be immobile for one moment, you know? And then the OCD stuff was always, for him, I think the OCD, like I was always like a twitchy kid. I would flare my nostrils. I would shake my head a lot. I would wiggle my hands and my thumbs. My dad was less like that, but more like, again, he does this thing with his socks that I reference in the book where he would number his socks to the pairs because it drove him crazy when one sock was slightly more worn out than the other sock. And whenever we go to restaurants, he's very specific about his napkins and his forks and knives. He's always wiping up every little stain on the table, every little drip of water. So yeah, that was something I always noticed from a very young age. I don't think you have the language. I think when you're young, you're just like, man, dad is weird. And then as you get older, you're like, oh no, he has OCD and Tourette syndrome.
But it's probably like dad is weird and dad can be embarrassing because when somebody starts doing something unusual in a restaurant and you're a kid and it's your parent doing the thing that's weird, you just feel seen in a way you don't want to be seen?
Oh, yes. I was desensitized to being embarrassed by my parents at a very young age, I think. It's something that just happened. I was like, I was soaked in it, you know, and saturated in it from the time I can remember. My dad used to try to embarrass us. He would drop us off at school dressed crazy in silly costumes, silly outfits, like specifically because he knew it embarrassed us. He would actively try to do things that humiliated us.
Why would he do that?
Because he thought it was funny and because he thought it was silly that we were embarrassed by it. And to this day, he does it. He still does things that are outwardly embarrassing. And when I point them out, he acts like I'm this like puritanical, like he likes to eat with his hands. Still, to this day at restaurants, he'll order a salad and he wants to eat it with his hands, which is, it's fine when we're at home alone. But it's just like, I'm like when you're in restaurants, it's like, you don't want to look over and just see a guy like eating a Caesar salad with his bare hands. It's just like not, you know? And so I would always be like, dad, just use a fork when we're out in public, at least, please. Just when we're at a nice restaurant, use a fork. And he's always like, oh, fine. Like, oh my God. Like I didn't realize I was out to dinner with like the Queen of England. I gotta use a fork for my salad. Jeez. Like he could not be more put out by it. It's to this day. Yeah.
You said he treats you as if you're puritanical sometimes. Never heard the word puritanical and Seth Rogen used in the same sentence before. This is
no, it's funny. Because he doesn't say it to me often. There was an interview in the New York Times recently and he gave a quote to it. And it was funny because it was something he'd never said to me. But in the article, he's like, I didn't think Seth would be such like a workaholic nerd. Like he's like Alex P. Keaton from Family Ties. Like, and I was like, that's how my dad sees me.
Your father's a socialist, right?
Exactly. So to him, I'm just like this like uptight, like
bow tie wearing.
Yeah, bow tie wearing. It's like, it's so funny.
So what was it like in school for you? Because you write that you also had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So between that and the twitchiness of a very mild case of Tourette's, that's a lot of activity.
Yeah, I did very bad in school always. And like my teachers did not like me. I was getting kicked out of class all the time. Like in elementary school, I would just get kicked out of class all the time. Like, which is a funny thing when you think about it. Like that's how they would just deal with me. It would just be like, go stand in the hall alone, which was, I understand why. It was maybe the best thing to do with me at that moment. But yeah, and then in high school, I really just stopped caring about school and very quickly was like, this is not going to be my path to success in life. And would go, I would say I had a casual relationship with attending high school in general.
And you ended up dropping out of high school because you got the part on Freaks and Geeks. So I guess dropping out of high school was for you no great loss since you were hardly in it in the first place.
No, it felt more like the conclusion of the very expected conclusion of what had been like a long downward spiral. Yeah. It was not surprising to anyone, I don't think. And nor did anyone, even my parents, no one really tried to convince me to like stay or even get like a GED. No one in my life was like, this is going to ruin your life if you drop out of high school. It was very clear by then that I was highly motivated to do other things, just not, you know, academic things.
So how did both the ADHD and the mild Tourette's affect, if at all, your ability to perform on stage?
You know, it didn't. And what was always interesting is that it would totally go away when I was on stage. I would have like a nervous, like I'm not a nerve. I would have like a cough sometimes, like a twitchy, like I would always like clear my throat kind of like, or I'd shake my head or I would flare my nostrils. Those were things I would do a lot. And whenever I went on stage, it completely went away. Like it never happened when I was on stage, which was always fascinating to me and always kind of showed me that it was not like a physical in the traditional sense thing that I had. You know what I mean? That it was in some way my brain was doing it because my brain could stop doing it. And also, when I smoked weed, it made it much better. Like, it really kind of relaxed me and put everything at ease a little bit and for sure eased a lot of those symptoms.
Yeah, I mean, you write in the book that you smoke weed to be normal, that you're not quite cut out for this world, and weed is what you think you need to make things work. So it helps with the symptoms that you have.
Yeah, for sure. It's something that, that just very much kind of, it's always something that just very much agreed with me, you know? I describe it as like putting on glasses that have the right prescription, you know? It's something that kind of as soon as I did it was like, yeah, this, like, I don't view, it. This doesn't feel like, I mean, the first times I did it, it felt like it was intoxicating in some way or really kind of taking me out of my element. But as I did it more, I think, like glasses, like the first time you put on glasses, everything looks crazy, even if they are your prescription, you know what I mean? And then eventually you're like, oh, no, this is how things are supposed to look. That's kind of how it was for me.
I want to talk with you about your experiences with weed and with drugs, but first I want to acknowledge that you weren't representative of all adolescents, that not all adolescents or even adults can be high and still function. I mean, you've managed to be incredibly productive while being high most of the time on weed, but not everybody is like that. And a lot of parents, I just want to acknowledge this before we go any further, that a lot of parents are really concerned about their children getting high at a young age when their brains are still developing. A lot of neurologists are concerned about that and are continuing to research, like, what are the effects of marijuana on the brain of a developing adolescent?
And for sure.
Yeah. So could we just acknowledge that before we move on? Yeah.
I don't know how many 13-year-old, fresh air heads there are, but if you are one, yes, do not smoke weed until you're older. And now it's federally legal in Canada, and the legal age, I think, is 18 or 19 or something, you know, so I think that, you know, I would follow the legality of wherever you are. But yeah, I started young. I started doing a lot of things young, you know, I would agree to that. I subscribe to that as well. My sister's a social worker. She deals with teens in crisis. And yes, she has very much warned me many times about, you know, suggesting that all 13-year-old kids should smoke weed.
So how has that affected, like, what you'll put into movies? Because you're continuing to make movies for teens among the other movies that you're making.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that we ever, I would say, you know, we make R-rated movies, so by nature, they're not something that you know, a lot of young kids can go see on their own without their parents taking them. But, you know, I think that being said, like, yeah, I mean, it's something that we are more aware of than we used to be, especially now that my friends have kids. There are things that I think when we were younger, honestly, looking at movies and things like that, our movies, I think we would, you know, we would justify certain things by saying, like, well, we're not condoning this behavior. Like, sure, the protagonist is doing it, but they're learning a lesson that they shouldn't do it in the end. But I think over the years, I've seen more that, like, if your protagonists are doing it, the nuance that maybe they've learned a lesson at some point in the movie that they shouldn't be doing that thing is lost on a lot of people, and most people just take, like, oh, that's a cool thing to do. And so that's something we've grown more aware of over the years, I would say.
So I want to change subjects here and talk about something that really surprised me in your book. You devote some time to talking about how when you were young, and you can tell me how old you were when this happened, that your father was asked by two friends who were lesbians, a lesbian couple, to be a sperm donor so that they could have children. And so you have two half-brothers through this lesbian couple. And how old were you?
I think I was 13 or 14 when I found out about them. And it was because the younger of the two was being born. So again, I'm terrible with years, but yeah, I think I'm around 16 years older than one of them and 13 years older than the other brother. Max and Ira are their names. They're lovely. And yeah, so I found out about my half-brothers, yeah, when I was, yeah, an early teen, a young teenager. But I knew their parents, and I believe I had met them too. Like, they were family friends, essentially. They weren't people we were, like, incredibly close with, but they were people I had seen, you know?
Who told you, and how did they tell you?
My parents told us. I remember, I think we were in my sister's room, which is weird, but that's vaguely where I remember them telling us that we had two half-brothers. And it was not that weird, honestly. It was, like, not... I remember not being incredibly phased by it. I remember thinking, like, oh, cool. That's a very cool thing for you to have done and for them to have asked you to do. And yeah, I was happy about it.
Would you describe your mother as a feminist?
Yes, very much so. I'd describe my father as a feminist too.
What did you learn about, like, gender equality growing up with a feminist mother doing comedy at a lesbian bar? You must have gotten, you know, a pretty good education in gender equality and LGBTQ equality.
Yeah, I think I did. Yeah. As you know, as well as I could absorb, you know. Yeah, my parents were friends with a lot of, you know, gay people and lesbians. And my parents had good friends that lived in a lesbian co-op, actually, that we would go hang out at. I remember there was a big... like, the woman symbol was like a giant mosaic on the tile floor of the courtyard of the housing complex. And I would hang out there a lot as a kid. And yeah, my dad was always really tried to instill in me to respect women as much as possible. And, you know, yeah. And I grew up going to a lot of marches and protests. And yeah, I think my parents were very and are progressive people and very much, you know, tried to pass that down on to me.
What impact did that have on you when you were going through your adolescence and teenage years and puberty and, you know, getting more and more sexually interested, you know,
yeah,
sexually obsessed or whatever, you
yeah.
know?
I think it made me err on the side of respect and caution, you know, and in general, it made me really not try to push myself on people, you know, and not try to assume that anyone wanted to engage in any physical act with me out of respect. There's a line in 40-Year-Old Virgin that I think of that I do kind of relate to, where Steve Carell's character is like, I respect women. I respect them so much I completely stay away from them. And that honestly kind of is what I was like.
Was the kind of masculinity you were taught by your family different from what you were learning from other boys who were your peers?
It's different from what I was seeing, but I think luckily, like, the friendships that became my close friendships were not guys like that, you know, for the most part. I obviously had terrible friends from time to time, but, you know, very bad ones. But in general, when I, you know, like the people, Sammy and Evan specifically, were the two people I spent the most time with, like, we were like nerds, you know what I mean? Like, we would play video games and smoke weed and we were obsessed with movies. Like, it was not like a sexually charged environment, to the degree that, like, that's what Superbad was all about when we started writing it, was just like how terrified we were to even, like, speak to girls, really, you know.
But you know, the Jonah Hill character in Superbad, one of the girls is throwing a party. They need alcohol. He volunteers to get it, even though he's underage, and enlists the Michael Cera character to help him buy it. And the premise of that is he says, you know how girls say, I was too drunk last night, I shouldn't have had sex with that guy? We could be that mistake. You know, like, if we just get the girls drunk enough, we could be that mistake and have sex with them. I don't think you were holding him up as exemplary. But
no, but they don't do it. I mean, again, speaking to what I was saying earlier, where it's like your characters learn lessons ultimately. So, you know, what they say, and this is something I've, again, grown more sensitive to, is like, as a writer in my head, a line like that is like, yes, that is what he thinks at the beginning of the movie. And throughout the journey of the film, he learns that that is a terrible mentality and that is not at all what he should be doing. And that he thinks that because he's terrified and because he thinks he's not worthy of a relationship, and he thinks the only reason a woman would ever hook up with him was if it was a lapse in judgment, you know. And ultimately, when confronted with a drunk woman who is ready to hook up, they don't do it, the characters, you know. So, like, it is the kind of thing where, and again, it's something I've grown to learn, which is like, yes, if you have your protagonist, like, just because as a writer I can defend a line like that in context, out of context, yeah, that's a terrible thing to hear someone say, you know. and the lead character of my film is saying it. So, like, I understand how that is something that a lot in my life and career is something that, it's something, it's interesting because it's something that people put on comedies, honestly, that I do find they don't put on other genres. Like, you know, John Wick murders a lot of people. I don't often hear people being like, is it bad that your protagonist is condoning, like, the murder of hundreds of people as an act of revenge? You know, and so I think, like, and the lesson he learns is that revenge is bad and it's a bad cycle, you know. I do think with comedies, sometimes people project that this is us saying these things, not that we are smart enough to understand that these are characters that are saying bad things and learning lessons ultimately, you know. Yeah, it's an interesting evolving conversation, though.
Well, Seth Rogen, it's been great to talk with you again. Thanks so much for coming back on our show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Seth Rogen's new memoir is called Yearbook. Our film critic Justin Chang says the captivating new drama, The Disciple, is one of the best movies he's seen this year. The film won the Best Screenplay Prize at last year's Venice International Film Festival. It tells the story of a young man from Mumbai who aspires to be a great classical Indian singer. Here's Justin's review.
Before I saw The Disciple, I knew nothing about Hindustani or Northern Indian classical music. By the end of the movie, I knew a little bit more, though I'd still be hard-pressed to follow the different intonations that singers bring to their performances, or to explain how a raga works. That's the musical framework that allows performers to improvise. Fortunately, no expertise is needed to appreciate The Disciple, which is both a welcome introduction to a kind of music we rarely hear on screen, and a richly layered story of a young man's artistic struggle. His name is Sharad, and he's played with great depth and emotional subtlety by Aditya Modak. It's 2006, and the 24-year-old Sharad lives in Mumbai with his grandmother, working occasionally, but spending most of his time studying his chosen art form. Hindustani classical music doesn't just require impeccable technique and brilliant improvisation. It's an all-consuming discipline, demanding a level of spiritual purity that singers can spend a lifetime trying to achieve. We learn some of this from the lectures that Sharad listens to as he rides his motorbike at night around Mumbai, in scenes that capture a calmer side of this famously bustling city. We also spend a lot of time watching and listening to him practice. The writer-director Chaitanya Tamhani immerses us in this music, letting us get used to its distinct sounds and rhythms. During this practice session, Sharad sits cross-legged on the floor and takes turns singing with his longtime teacher and guru, played by Arun Dravid. His is the first voice you hear. Sharad is completely devoted to his craft, but he's an erratic performer at best. His uninspired singing gets him ejected early from a young artist's competition, and his guru doesn't hesitate to criticize him during rehearsals, and even during a public performance. The disciple throws cold water on the notion, much beloved by so many inspirational movies, that hard work and a little luck are all it takes. It's an unsparing portrait of artistic frustration. About halfway through, the movie leaps ahead to roughly the present day and becomes an almost satirical depiction of the Indian music scene. Sharad is older and a lot more cynical, working as a schoolteacher and trying to keep his performing career afloat. He watches with both contempt and envy as a younger singer becomes an overnight sensation on an American Idol-style reality TV show. And in perhaps the movie's most emotionally lacerating scene, he has an ill-advised sit-down with a veteran music critic who witheringly dismisses Sharad's heroes, including his beloved guru. We critics, of course, make convenient movie villains. But what sets The Disciple apart is how fairly it treats all its characters, and how scrupulously it refuses to take sides. Tamhani sympathizes with Sharad through all his disappointments, and he clearly shares his belief that his art is worth pursuing and preserving. But he's also too honest a filmmaker to indulge Sharad's self-pity. Even the director's exquisite visual approach, aided here by the Polish cinematographer Michał Sobocinski, winds up subtly undermining Sharad and putting his struggles in perspective. As in Tamhani's excellent 2014 legal drama, Court, nearly every scene consists of a single uninterrupted take, framed at a careful remove from the characters. We're drawn into the cramped little rooms where Sharad practices and the large, crowded music halls where he performs. This is Aditya Modak's screen debut, and the lack of close-ups makes his performance all the more impressive. Even at a distance, and with very few words, he conveys Sharad's bitterness and disillusionment as his life refuses to go as planned. While The Disciple harks back to classic Indian films like Satyajit Ray's The Music Room, it also carries stylistic echoes of Alfonso Cuarón's similarly meditative and gorgeously photographed movie, Roma. That's no accident. Tamhani, who's 34, was mentored by Cuarón and worked on the set of Roma. Cuarón in turn provided guidance on The Disciple and is credited as an executive producer. There's something poignant about that, given how much the story focuses on the student-teacher relationship and the way artistic traditions are passed down. The Disciple may tell a story about failure, but it's a triumphant achievement from a gifted film artist.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed The Disciple, which is now streaming on Netflix. My guest Jean Smart has been getting roles that really show off what she can do. In the TV series Fargo, she played the hardened matriarch of a crime family. Last year, in the HBO series Watchmen, she played an FBI agent. Now she's co-starring in the HBO crime and family drama Mayor of Easttown as the mother of Kate Winslet's character. Her comedic timing was obvious in the 80s sitcom Designing Women and in the early 2000s when she won two Emmys for her guest starring role in Frasier. She's returned to comedy in the new series Hacks on HBO Max. In Hacks, She plays Deborah Vance, a comic who overcame a lot of the obstacles women comics of her generation faced and became a top act in Vegas, where she regularly performs at one of the big casinos. When the series begins, her career is in decline. Her jokes are kind of funny, but way past their expiration dates. The casino is cutting back her dates and is trying to book an act that can draw a younger crowd. In an attempt to save Deborah's career, her manager pairs her with a young woman comedy writer, Ava Daniels, who he also manages, to write material for Deborah that will sound more up to date. Ava, played by Hannah Einbinder, thinks of herself as cutting edge and cringes at the idea of writing for a comic she considers washed up and too show busy. But Ava desperately needs work because she was canceled after tweeting a joke about a closeted senator who sent his gay son to conversion therapy. So Ava reluctantly flies to Vegas to meet with Deborah, and Deborah grudgingly hires her. At one of their first meetings, Deborah tells Ava that the jokes she's written for her aren't funny. Then Deborah asks Ava if she's a lesbian, to which Ava responds that Deborah is her employer, which makes it inappropriate for her to ask that. And then Ava goes on to describe in graphic detail her sexual experiences with women and men and concludes by telling Deborah this.
So anyway, I'm bi.
Jesus Christ, I was just wondering why you were dressed like Rachel Maddow's mechanic.
Great, so the jokes? You didn't like any?
They're not jokes. I mean, they're like thought poems. I had a horrible nightmare that I got a voicemail. What?
It's funny because voicemails are annoying. It's like just text.
First of all, if you start a sentence with, it's funny because, it is probably not. And second, jokes need a punchline.
Well, in my opinion, traditional joke structure is very male. It's so focused on the ending. It's all about the climax.
Oh, look who's talking. I just got a TED talk about yours.
Jean Smart, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. You're terrific in this, as you've been.
Thank you.
For so long. So, you know, you've done a lot of comedy, but this is the first time you've played a comic. Do you have any favorite jokes of the bad jokes that your character tells? Because they're both funny and bad at the same time.
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, I don't think of her jokes as bad necessarily. It's just that, you know, she's sort of got her stock style of jokes and that she knows her audience really well, and she knows what they expect and what they don't want to hear from her. And she gives them what they pay for, you know. I mean, as risque as she gets, it was probably the first joke we hear out of her mouth at the very beginning of the show, where you can just kind of hear her before we even see her face, where she talks about being in bed with a guy who keeps saying, you know, are you close, are you close? And she says, yeah, I'm close. I'm close to getting a buzz cut, a flannel shirt, and finally accepting Melissa Etheridge's dinner invite. I love that joke.
So you have two series now, a comedy and a drama, Hacks and Mayor of Easttown, the series that you're co-starring in on HBO. That's part crime drama and part family drama. Kate Winslet plays Mayor Sheehan, who's a police detective trying to solve a murder, but there's a lot going on in her personal life. Her son died by suicide, leaving behind his young son, who Mayor is raising because the boy's mother has been in rehab. You're Mayor's mother, and you've moved in with Mayor to help her raise the grandson, your great-grandson. But you and Mayor are afraid that you're about to lose custody because the boy's mother is getting out of rehab. You've been trying to prepare him for the likelihood he'll be returning to his mother. And that's made Mayor very angry with you because she wants to keep custody. And let's hear a clip in which she's showing how angry she is that you're trying to prepare him to go back to his mother. The clip starts with Kate Winslet as Mayor.
Why are you telling him you might have to go live with his mom?
Because he might have to go live with his mom.
He's 4 years old, Mom. We don't know what's going to happen, all right? Don't be telling him stuff like that. He's lived in this house his entire life, Mom.
Which is why we need to prepare him. Otherwise, he'll feel like the ground has just fallen out beneath him.
I called Kathy Dreyer's today.
You did what?
She works over the Child and Youth Services.
I know where Kathy Dreyer's works. Why the hell are you calling her?
Because I want to find out how this whole custody thing works.
It's not
she
your place,
told
Mom.
Me.
Carrie has a place to
it's
stay.
It's so
Mom,
out of line for you to be telling
clean.
Him stuff
and
like
takes
that,
her
Mom.
Men. Please.
She is his mother. She's the mother. She'll get custody. And there's not a damn thing you or I can do about it.
I'll figure something out.
What's there to figure out?
Hello?
You're not his guardian.
I know that.
Mom.
You don't have to say
stay
that.
Stay out of it. Okay? Understand me?
Wow, you're really good in this. How did you get the part?
They offered it to me. It was lovely. And I said, HBO, Kate Winslet, unless I really hate the part, I'll say yes right now. But I love their relationship because, I mean, even though it's a bit dysfunctional, I hope that it comes across to the audiences there is still love and respect there between them. They've been through so much. And like a lot of families who go through suicide and divorce and things, that there's a lot of blame, there's a lot of regret, but they still manage to, you know, eke out a life together and find moments of humor and moments of happiness.
So Mare of Easttown is set in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. And Delaware County has some pretty wealthy neighborhoods and some working class suburbs. And you probably saw this or at least heard about it, that Saturday Night Live did a parody of the accents.
Yes.
Did you see it of the accents on Mare of Easttown?
Kate sent it to me.
Yeah, and she's the one who got the brunt of the
it was hilarious.
Of the satire in this. And the premise of the show is that instead of saying murder and daughter because of the perhaps overly exaggerated Philadelphia accents, it's like I can't even do it right. Mortar and daughter. Yeah, you do it.
Well, I don't know quite where they were going with some of it, but yes, they called it murder dirter, murder daughter. But yes, like one of the examples of that accent is the way they say water. It's water, like almost like W-O-O-D-E-R. You know, give me a glass of water, water.
So did you have like an accent coach?
Oh, yes. No, we had a couple wonderful dialect coaches. Mine was a native from the area, and she was extremely helpful. And I would put my lines on a loop tape on my phone and just fall asleep listening to it. I'd sometimes use my right ear so it would get in the left side of my brain, and sometimes I'd listen with my left ear so it would get in the right side of my brain, and I'd listen to it on the way to work. And because you want it to be as automatic as possible, because if you're thinking about it while you're doing your lines, then you're not thinking about the right things. But you're supposed to be thinking about it, what your character's supposed to be thinking about. That's the hard part of doing an accent, but it's always fun to do.
Well, Jean Smart, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. And I want to say, I'm very sorry because I know you lost your husband in March, and I know you must still be grieving. And I appreciate that you're trying to carry on, and I appreciate you coming to our show and talking about your work and your life. I know from my own life and from other people who I'm close to that there are times when the career seems to be going so well, but there's something that's so awful or tragic that's happened in one's personal life. And I feel like that's the situation that you're in now.
Yeah, I was talking about a friend with that the other night who said, oh, no, don't go there. And I said, I really don't think that way, that the other shoe has to drop. Or I've always been a very optimistic person. I always felt like a lucky person. I mean, I've had loss in my life. I lost my beloved sister 11 years ago. Still miss her terribly. But I don't believe that if one part of your life is going well, that means that something bad is going to happen necessarily. But it did it did kind of feel that way at first because it was very unexpected. It was his heart. We had no reason to believe whatsoever that he had any issues with his heart. So it was very shocking. And it was right when we'd just both gotten vaccinated. There was this wonderful kind of giddy sense of relief. I was doing my dream job, and I just was feeling very, very positive about everything, just feeling like there's so much ahead of us and so many things we can do. And so there was a part of me in dark moments where I thought, this is the universe looking down and saying, oh, you thought you could have it all, huh? Not so fast. I don't like to think that that's true. I hope not. That would sort of prevent you from ever enjoying anything in your life. You're looking over your shoulder all the time. And I don't want my children to be, you know, cynical at all. They're having enough, you know, on their shoulders, although I think they're handling this better than I am. Mother's Day was rough, and I didn't necessarily expect that, but that was very, very hard. But, you know, he really kind of put his own career on the back burner so that I could take advantage of these amazing opportunities I've gotten these last several years, and I wouldn't be here, you know, without him, you know, and I just wish I could enjoy it with him, you know.
He was an actor. You met on the set of Designing Women.
Yes, he's a wonderful actor.
It must have been strange because he played Annie Potts' boyfriend, so you had to watch him being somebody else's boyfriend. Was that strange?
No, it was funny because, I mean, well, we had just met and we worked together that first. We were never apart after the day we met. And I'd watch scenes where he was kissing Annie, you know, and thought, oh, he's so cute. I invited him into my trailer to play Scrabble. And he invited me to come and see a play that he was doing. It was a horrible play, but he was absolutely hilarious in it. And I went like three or four or five, six times. And then his producers kept begging me to come back when there were reviewers in the audience because I would always laugh and I would get the audience laughing. I don't know. I guess something about my laugh. I don't know. But we were never apart. It's actually a great way to meet somebody at work when you have to be together, but it's not a date. It's great because you're getting to know each other with no pressure of feeling like, oh God, we're on a date, you know. Just like, well, we're together all day because we have to be together all day.
But then you have to ask yourself, am I supposed to keep this a secret from the other people who I'm working with?
No, I don't remember feeling that way because I remember I found out that Delta had worked with him on Love Boat once. So I said, go find out if he's married or has a girlfriend or something. So she marched up to him and said, Gene wants to know if you're married or have a girlfriend. It's like, yeah, thanks, Delta.
So no secrets there. She was in on it at the beginning.
Yes.
It's strange, you know, like during the epidemic, I've known so many people who've gotten sick, who've had surgery, who've died, who've, you know, like some horrible health crisis not related to COVID, more than usual. I don't know if you've experienced that too. I mean, certainly with your husband, but it just, I don't know. I don't know what to make of it.
I know, I have two friends who lost their husbands.
Really?
In the last 6 months. Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously my husband didn't have COVID, but I still feel like he was a victim of the pandemic because I took him when he started not feeling well. I thought it was a delayed reaction to the immunization because he'd gotten very sick from the second one. So I took him to urgent care because he hated hospitals and doctors. He didn't want to go to the hospital. Took him to urgent care. And even though he was 71 and complaining of tightness in his chest, they didn't do an EKG. And the hospital later was shocked that they didn't. But he just started getting worse. And I said, you know, this is crazy. I'm taking you to the hospital. And that was when they realized how sick he was.
I'm just so sorry. And I appreciate your strength in continuing to work and to move forward. And I'll just add one thing about that. When I was growing up and I lived in an apartment building and the neighbor right upstairs from me, her husband died, and I felt like, well, I know what it's like for women who lose their husband. That means it's the end of their life. Because most women then, they didn't work. Their identity had so much to do with their marriage. Their income was completely tied up with their marriage. And, you know, I thought, like, what is left for somebody after their husband dies? I don't know if you grew up thinking that, too.
I don't remember thinking that exactly, but for some reason, even though my mom was a housewife, I didn't ever expect that a man would support me or take care of me. And I don't know why I thought that. I really don't. I can't base that on anything. But with Hacks, when Richard passed, I had to finish the show. I had a week's worth of work left to shoot. And that was very, very scary and distressing. But I had to. I mean, we had to finish the show. And I, being the lead of the show, I mean, I feel a huge responsibility for the success of the show and feel a responsibility to the crew and the cast. But they could not have been more accommodating and more wonderful to me.
Well, I just want to end by saying that, you know, I love your acting. And
thank you.
I admire your strength. And I wish you well during this period.
Thank you.
And, you know, thank you for coming on our show, in spite of the fact that I'm sure you're still grieving. And I apologize if I'm sounding clumsy in expressing all these things, but
no, it's hard. I mean, I have two friends who lost their husbands this year, and I sympathized and everything, but I didn't have a clue what they were going through. Not a clue. It's indescribable.
Yeah. Well, what can I say? Thank you, and I wish you well.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
My interview with Jean Smart was recorded earlier this month. She stars in the new HBO Max comedy series Hacks, and she co-stars in the HBO series Mayor of Easttown.